Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I want to begin with a very short poem by Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies, too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. It's a really beautiful short poem. Tell the truth, but tell it slant. Success in presenting the truth in circuit lies, in indirection. Why? Because the truth is too bright for our infirm or weak delight. The truth's superb surprise must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. I think one of the problems with our current culture, there are many, there are also many hopeful signs, I think, as well, but one of them is that we have lost this sense of the truth as a surprise. We've lost the sense of the truth as something that dazzles. And we've lost the sense of presenting the truth slant. We're hectoring, yelling, preaching, arguing with one another constantly with very little delight whatsoever and without any sense that maybe we ought to back up and think about how we communicate with friends and foes alike when it comes to the presentation of the truth, and indeed when it comes to our own apprehension and pursuit of the truth. And about beauty, as about truth, we suffer from what the contemporary Catholic Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor calls inarticulacy. We don't have a rich vocabulary, particularly a rich shared public vocabulary, for thinking about the things that matter to us most, for thinking about death, for thinking about birth, for thinking about joy, for thinking about anguish and suffering. We also don't have a really rich vocabulary for thinking about beauty or about ugliness. One of the philosophers I like to teach I'm teaching this semester both a moral philosophy and a philosophy of art class, and I have them reading Iris Murdoch, who was a philosopher at Oxford in the mid-century, one of the handful of really powerful female philosophers who was led into Oxford when the men were off fighting in the war, and a good friend of the great Catholic philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe. And Murdoch, I love teaching Murdoch to my undergrads because Murdoch says, you know, the problem for us is not really that we don't know what's good and what's evil. There might be some really difficult questions, but moment to moment, we have a pretty good idea what we ought to do and what we ought not to do. And where we do real damage, Murdoch thinks, is when we simply haven't seen or heard or recognized the people in our midst and the moral claims that they're actually making upon us. Murdoch has a rather secular Calvinist view of human nature. It's a pretty dark view. She worries about what she calls the anxious, avaricious tentacles of the self. That's a mouthful. The anxious, avaricious tentacles of the self, which she thinks, consciously or unconsciously, mostly unconsciously, lead us in our moment-to-moment reflections about ourselves, how we present ourselves to others, how we want people to respond to us. These selfish tentacles lead us to warp the external world in light of our own fantasies and illusions. So Murdoch says the fundamental problem of moral philosophy is what she calls unselfing. I've got to get myself out of the way of my capacity to see and respond and what's actually out there. She discusses in this great essay she wrote called The Sovereignty of the Good, various strategies for unselfing, the first of which is the experience of the beautiful. Murdoch says, the experience of something that is genuinely beautiful is something that catches you up and arrests your attention. And for the time that you are experiencing as beautiful, you forget yourself. You might say even that there's a kind of transcendence of time and of self, right? In something that's really enjoyable and beautiful, you can lose track of time. Think about our friendships and the time we spend with friends. We can lose track of time and we can lose track of ourselves. We might have gone in to a group gathering of friends or to see a movie or to hear a concert, burdened by all sorts of anxieties about ourselves. But if we are genuinely moved by the artwork, we forget ourselves. It's why art can have this healing and refreshing effect upon us. It unselfs us. Jacques Maritain, the great French Thomist from the 20th century, who wrote probably more than any other students of Thomas on beauty and actually spent a great deal of time amongst artists. The great French painter Georges Rouault was a lifetime friend. Marc Chagall, the great French, the great Jewish, Russian emigre, was close with his wife who had converted from Judaism to Catholicism. Stravinsky, one of the most radical composers of the early part of the 20th century, had in effect a classical conversion, partly prompted by his conversations with Maritain. And Maritain says that beauty, the experience of harmony between our faculties of sensing, imagining, and thinking, and a beautiful object returns us momentarily, Maritain says, to the terrestrial paradise. It returns us to a brief experience of a harmony within our souls and between our souls and the created universe. So beauty can have an enormously positive effect on our souls. The other thing I think that's important about the experience of beauty for people like Murdoch and Maritain is that it gets us, it helps to curb one illusion that we're fostering in our culture all the time, which is that we are the makers of our own or writers of our own story. Sometimes universities, I'm happy to say I don't think Baylor does this where I now teach, come here and you can write your own story. Well, we do play really important roles in our stories, but none of us can stand outside of our lives like a dramatist, an author of a drama does, and write the thing from scratch. There's one of my favorite lines in The Lord of the Rings is Sam and Frodo are making their way toward Mordor, and they have a break in the tension. And Sam starts to talk about the difference between the kind of stories that they like to read in the Shire and the kind of stories that you want to live. The kind of stories that you like to read about are full of danger, violence, nobility, courage, treachery, and the threat of death. The kind of story you want to live in the Shire is having three or four breakfasts and smoking whatever the hobbits are smoking after dinner in their pipes. That's the kind of story that you want to live. And Sam says, you know, Frodo, I fear that we're living one of those stories that we would rather just be reading about. And then he goes on to say this, He says, it seems to me that the folk in the old tales just found themselves in those stories. They didn't go out looking for adventure. It came to them. This beautiful line, this question that he asks, he says, I wonder, Master Frodo, what story we've fallen into. And that's a beautiful way of thinking about our lives. It's a beautiful way of thinking about how stories entrance us by pulling us into something that's already going on and that we participate in vicariously if we're just listening to them or reading them. It's also really important for thinking about how we think about our own role in the stories that we have inherited. And I think beauty itself, because it unselfs, because it calls us into something that is not me, but which seems, at least momentarily, to fulfill or enhance or perfect me. Beauty has or can have the effect of countering this sense that I am in control of everything, and everything, in a sense, obeys my will. Matt Crawford, who's a political theorist, bike repair guy, motorcycle repair guy, had a famous article some years ago called Shop Class as Soulcraft, a great book about the importance of manual work for the training and the virtues. And in one of his more recent books called The World Beyond Your Head, he says that life as we live it largely on screens today holds out the prospect for us of a frictionless universe. That is to say, a universe that doesn't push back against my will. Because I am the arbiter, except I now know that all sorts of algorithms are working, manipulating me as I think I'm in complete control on social media or wherever I might be. But I have the illusion, Crawford thinks, of a frictionless universe. Whereas, and here he uses, I think, somewhat effectively, at least for these purposes, he uses Freud, who says, well, the child is dominated by the pleasure principle, but the adult has to be governed by the reality principle, by the fact that the world and other people push back against my will. This is another way of saying that really good, beautiful, gripping stories and artworks take me out of a position of thinking or experiencing my will as being in control. So there can be a really salutary effect of a regular experience of beauty. Another affliction that we have that's connected to what I was just talking about is the inability to rest. The desperate desire to find rest, to sleep, to let go of things. And once again, the experience of what is beautiful by drawing us out of ourselves can teach us to attend to the world, can get us out of the way and allow us to see others and to see the world as it is. Maybe even to see the dazzling truths that are all around us. Unless we have a habit of stillness, of receptivity, and of attending, we may get truths in terms of propositions, but we will not experience what Dickinson calls the dazzling, almost blinding attractiveness of truth. Years ago, when I was teaching philosophy at Boston College, we had very good students, had a lot of philosophy majors. They wrote really good papers. I was frustrated at a certain point by what I found by getting to know students outside of class there, at the gap between what was going on in class and what was going on outside of class. And not just the gap in terms of behavior, but the gap in terms of a lack of reflection on students' part as to how the philosophy they were studying in class might bear upon how they were leading their lives. And so, mentioned that I'd written a book on film, this book that I wrote on nihilism and popular culture. I taught a class at BC on philosophy and film. And what I found, and I find this to this day, I just put a bunch of images of 19th century romantic landscapes up on a PowerPoint yesterday with my students at Baylor. And what I found was that as a teacher, I could have the kinds of conversations that I really hope to have with students through using film and art that was more difficult to have with an argument. Arguments are very important. Don't get me wrong. I'm a philosopher. I make my money off of arguments. I think they're important for us, not just because they keep philosophers in business, but because they're intrinsically important, that we learn how to reason, that we learn how to argue clearly and rigorously. We learn how to take objections seriously. But arguments are straight at you. And we've often got, in the midst of arguments, our defenses up or our attack mode up. When we step back and look at a work of art, look at a story, there's this really brutal, tough, but I think artistically well done film called The Ice Storm that I had students watch in class. And it's set in New Canaan, Connecticut, and it's really about the adverse effects of the sexual revolution on families. It's a completely secular story. But the ice storm is something that happens over a Thanksgiving break. And the ice is, in a kind of Shakespearean way, symbolic of the frozen souls in this community, particularly the parents, and the adverse impact on their children. And I would have students, this, I had 100 students in this class, I would have them watch the film on a Sunday night. They all gathered to watch it, and then we come in on Monday. And I came in, and it's a big class, so I'm trying to make some jokes, get things going, get the students interested, and nobody is, they're all just still, just stunned. And I'm thinking to myself, did something happen on campus of which I'm unaware? And I said, What's going on? What's bothering you? And there was one kid I'd had in class before sitting about three quarters of the way up, and he raised his hand and he said, you know those other films we watched? He said, they were entertaining and interesting, but the people in the ice storm, he was from this part of Connecticut. He said, those people could be me, or I could be them. I know families like this. And in a way that never would have happened through just reading Aristotle's Ethics or Mill on utilitarianism, this student was able to see the implications of a narrative in terms of what counted as success and failure, what were virtues and vices, and how they played out in the souls of the characters. And that led to a 50-minute discussion that's one of the greatest discussions I've ever had with students in all the many years that I've been teaching. Why? Because the narrative, the beauty, was disarming. It wasn't coming at them as an argument. It enabled them to step back and relax and view the story and get caught up in it. And then that led to a conversation that was extremely fruitful. I find this all the time, as I mentioned, works of art, playing music. One of the things that also happens in these discussions is shared insight. Yeah, I see that now, what you're pointing out. Or sometimes I don't see that at all, and I don't find this pleasant in the way you do, or beautiful. And that learning to navigate shared insight and disagreement, where we're not at one another, but we're talking about an object, is useful for discourse, for civil discourse. Come back to that in a moment. Beauty's also at the heart of truth as worship, or worship of truth. Seems to me the same experience that we have, or an analogous experience that we have, that Murdoch's describing in being unselfed by what is beautiful, happens to us in prayer, in the liturgy, in sacred song, which is that we are caught up in something bigger than ourselves. We are caught up in something that's transcendent, and particularly in the Mass, we are caught up in the liturgy where time and eternity, where God becomes man, where the sacrifice of Christ to the Father on our behalf is participated in by us in the Eucharistic sacrifice. When Aquinas talks about contemplation, he talks about it in two related but different ways. And if you're interested in finding this in the Summa, there's a conversation at the very beginning of the second part where he talks about the ultimate end of human life, which he says is contemplation of the truth and ultimately contemplation of God. There's a lot of Aristotle in that part. And good, I like Aristotle. It's well used by Aquinas and recognized as true. At the very end of the second part of the Summa, he takes up the question of states of life. And he asks the question whether the purely contemplative life or the purely active life is superior. And on those terms, he says the contemplative life is superior because it's about what we're ultimately aiming toward. It's about directing our attention to God. But then he makes an argument, and it's in a sense a defense of the Dominican way of life, the mendicant way of life, which mixes contemplation and action. There's one sort of life that is higher than the purely contemplative life. It's the life where contemplation overflows into teaching, preaching, and serving others. This famous tagline for the Dominicans in Latin, contemplata aliis tradere, to hand on to others things contemplated. As he articulates his account of this, he says, first of all, that this contemplation overflowing is a surplus. It's an experience of the truth and the goodness of God that naturally overflows into teaching and preaching. Beauty is central to his account of this way of life where contemplation overflows into action, being superior to either the merely active or the merely contemplative. He says at one point, from the love of God, we are inflamed to gaze on his beauty. Our hearts are lit with a fire, a desire for divine beauty that invades our soul and takes, in a sense, possession of it, pulling us, he calls this a kind of ecstasy, where we stand outside ourselves. Just as this is much richer than what Murdoch's talking about with unselfing. This is a standing outside of oneself that is a standing in God. This experience of ecstasy and of a kind of rapturous beauty for Aquinas naturally leads us to want to share this with others. We all experience this, right? At the natural level. If there's something that you really love that you've discovered, or a song that you just heard, what do you want to do? You want to share that with your friends. There are moments of experience of beauty that are very rich in solitude, I think, as well. But something that we really find captivating and surprising and wondrous and dazzling, right? You don't just want to hold that for yourself. You want to share it with the people you love. I think there's actually a really brilliant insight that Aquinas has there for why the contemplative life that is rooted in a surplus of contemplation naturally overflows, and that this is perfective. It's also an imitation of the divine, because God chooses not simply to rest in his own truth, goodness, and beauty, but to create out of sheer gratuity from nothing a cosmos and to create beings in that cosmos to whom he can communicate the beauty of creation, the beauty of other human beings, all of which reflect, if they're rightly ordered, the beauty, goodness, and truth of God. So we are, in fact, imitating God, in a sense, in the highest way for Aquinas, not just when we behold and cling to the truth, but when that truth, through its dazzling beauty, so takes possession of our soul that it overflows through the impulse of charity to share it with others through teaching, preaching, and service. I think there's also an important lesson here, not just for how we ought to encounter the truth. Whenever we're encountering important truths, we're missing something if the element of the beautiful is not present there, if the element of mystery is not present there, the element of encountering something that's too great for my comprehension. We're also missing something in the communication of truth if we think it's just about arguments. I mentioned this already with my moral philosophy and philosophy of art classes. I think maybe this part is more important for us today than anything else that I've been talking about. When we're arguing, trying to present the truth, doing apologetics, whatever it might be, the first thing we have to realize is that we're engaging not just with detached, disembodied minds, but with fully alive, complex human persons. And we have a tendency in our culture, especially on social media, but increasingly what we do online sadly informs how we interact in person. We have a tendency to want to reduce people to an ideological checklist. And if you don't do it, it's been done to you at one time or another. Our default position on social media is often that anyone who disagrees with me is both stupid and evil, and I'm going to show you with these really clever lines in my next post how stupid and evil you are. Now, granted, there are people, especially online, who are not operating at the highest level of intellectual rigor or integrity. And sometimes those are the same people. So there are people out there who are not operating with rigor or with goodwill. The problem with how many people in America today interact on social media is that this is our default position. This is where we start. I want to end that I didn't know that we had an oratory here until I arrived. I want to end with a couple of quotes from John Henry Newman. Newman says in this beautiful sermon that he gave called Personal Influence, The Means of Propagating the Truth. Truth is upheld in the world. This is a pretty strong set of negations he's going to give us here. Truth is upheld in the world, not as a system, not by books, not by argument, not by temporal power, but by the personal influence of those who in the areas of wisdom and holiness are teachers and patterns of it. So the truth is upheld. Newman gives lots of arguments. So he's not saying arguments are unimportant. He wrote a really long book, which I'll quote from in a moment, The Idea of a University, which is all about universities as being focused on the pursuit of truth for its own sake. The pursuit of truth in its complexity and unity for Newman is what the university is about. But he goes on in the sermon to say, nothing is more effectual, first in irritating, then in humbling the pride of man, then the personal influence of individuals who embody what they teach. I mentioned the idea of a university. Very similar view in broad outline to Aquinas' idea of what a university would be about. It's about multiple disciplines and pursuing the truth in its diversity in those disciplines, but also in its unity, with ultimately with theology as a unifying discipline for all the other disciplines. But Newman ends idea of a university in a really strange way. Having argued about argument and curricula and the pursuit of truth, he turns to Philip Neri, whose mission, he says, was not mainly academic, nor was it mainly the propagation of the faith, nor the exposition of doctrine, nor the catechetical schools, although Neri was certainly, like Newman, interested in all those things. Through what Newman says is his convincing eloquence of his personal character and his easy conversation, known as one of the easiest people to talk to in his age. Through the convincing eloquence of his character and his easy conversation, he created for others a home of Christian mirth, of joy and hospitality, and thereby won over and converted many souls who otherwise would have never been moved to open themselves to the possibility that the truth of the gospel spoke to them.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.